Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lau.
So it's been a while since I did a D&D Next rant, although I'm sure nobody missed it. But the latest Legends and Lore article by Mike Merles, you know, said that it's been almost a year of open play tests so far, and he had an article about feats, which I know we all kind of like, and surprise, surprise, I disagree with what he says.
At least you disagree and not hate.
Well, I think that comes with saying D&D Next, you know? So he told, he started off the article by, you know, kind of relating a story about how he's a real big fan of feats and how he thinks that they're great ways to differentiate your character kind of mechanically and make your character's backstory fit the mechanics of your character. But then he kind of contrasts that by saying a person he, I guess, not introduced the game to, but, you know, the person said that feats were really difficult, and they were a veteran player, and they didn't really much like feats, and the whole character creation process ground to a halt. So for D&D Next, they were planning to, of course, try and make feats simpler, so that you didn't have the analysis paralysis that resulted in the rather sparse intro story he told. And, yep, as I said, I kind of disagree with what he said, that it appears that they want to make feats as powerful as a plus one boost to a stat. And the reason they want to do that is it'll allow people to choose either some kind of special ability, you know, like kind of like the feats we're used to in 3.5 and 3rd edition, or they can spend that feat slot on an actual plus one boost to an ability score, up to a cap of 20, which I think is the ability cap for D&D Next. And I don't know, I think that is a very kind of nebulous and difficult measurement to achieve. So I think it's kind of I'm going to say it's a dumb idea. No.
Cool. Yeah, I'm kind of in the same camp as you, Wayne. I don't know how odd it is that we agree on something in D&D, but
yeah, I know.
No, like, I love feats. I thought, like, when I started playing D&D 3.5, anyway, when I first saw feats, I thought they were really cool and really innovative and stuff, but that's really because I hadn't played many point-by games like GURPS or World of Darkness, so, you know, things like Merits had been around for a long time, but it was the first time that I'd seen something like that, so. But I thought it was just fantastic, and there's these cool little powers that you can use to customize your character to make them really unique, and, yeah, it's great. I mean, I usually, like I said before, I like to build characters kind of stats first with D&D, roll the stats, and then kind of apply classes and things. And feats is kind of the part where it really starts to feel like my character, like something unique. So, yeah, I love them.
No, I definitely agree with that. And I know the problem I'm having is that, as I said, a plus one bump to an ability score is really nebulous. You know, like that can be worth different things. The more a stat increases, you know, is a stat bump from 12, you know, to 13 worth the same amount as a bump from 19 to 20? You know, there are certain, I guess, step ups where it's going to be worth more.
Yeah.
And they also said that they want higher level feats to do more than lower level feats. And feats will have like a level requirement, which, again, I'm not really a fan of because it kind of seems, in my opinion, to go against them trying to simplify it. You know, if the problem is people are having sort of analysis paralysis and not being able to choose feats or not being able to decide which ones they want, why kind of, in my opinion, tack on more rules and have feats do more? It seems like, you know, higher level feats would be more complicated, which kind of defeats the purpose of streamlining them, in my opinion.
Well, they had higher level feats before. That's not new.
They had, like, Paragon-level feats as well, hey.
Were they more, quote-unquote, like, valuable than lower-level feats, or did they have, like, more stuff tacked onto them?
Yeah, no, they would look like definitely higher-level feats, like,
yeah.
And they would be like, you can't take this until 6th level or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, I think a lot of the feats had prerequisites of other feats, so you, well, with the leveling process, you know, you wouldn't be able to take them before 6th level. I don't remember many level requirements, and I'm thinking more 3, 5. But yeah, definitely the higher level ones, like Whirlwind Attack was one of the best ones. You could attack people on all sides of you, but you needed 4 or 5 feats to build up to that one. So yeah.
Yeah, I like feat trees, but the Whirlwind Attack was a bit much.
Well, I mean, it was kind of the pinnacle on that tree.
Yeah, but you needed to actually work from 2 trees. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to go the dodge, and you have to go
another one.
No, it's pretty good once you get it, but yeah, you pretty much have to commit to that set.
Very true. Like, you got to start from level 1 to get there. And I was really surprised at how much people were against, well, feats in general, but also, like, feat tree. Well, I mean, I read through the comments, and I was just surprised at how angry they were. There's a lot of angry gamers out there. But they had a good point that if you have these feat trees, it's quite limiting if you just want to do a one-shot or if you just want to roll something up really quick for a con game or something. So you have this wide array of really cool feats, but if you're starting with a first-level character, you can't take all but maybe this limited set. So it's hard to just put something together quickly and go, unless you wanted to create a high-level character. But again, that's not quick to create. So, I mean, I can understand that complaint about it, but maybe just as a personal bias, I like longer games, so feat trees suit me very fine. There's something to look forward to, I think.
Well, I was going to say, like, isn't there a rule on the internet about, you know, you never ever read the comments because you just lose all faith in humanity for whatever you're doing?
But it's so true.
I don't know. I don't really see that argument. It seems to me people want it both ways. You know, they want lots of choice and customization, but then they don't want to put in the work to build the character, and they're complaining that, you know, it takes a long time to build. I don't really see a way around that, you know, especially for one-shot or con games. It's like, well, either a game is usually designed for really short games or campaign. It can't really do both. Or, I don't know, maybe put in a little module that says, hey, you know, here's a quick way to make a 5th level, a 6th, 7th level, or a whatever level character. You know, just select these options. And, you know, you're sacrificing customization for speed. So. Yeah. The people who are complaining about that, I don't get it. You know, they seem to just be complaining.
Yeah, I don't really see that feats themselves are a difficult concept to grasp, so I'm not really sure about the story that Mike Merles tells, but the sheer number of feats can get a bit overwhelming.
Right.
So definitely whatever's going to be in the core book, they got to limit, maybe on 2 pages or something like that, and keep it to that for the core book. Oh, I'm on a nice movie roll.
Oh, yeah? What you got?
You guys are done talking about feats, right?
Yeah.
He's been sitting there counting the seconds on the hand.
Yeah, and you're done not talking about feats. Okay.
Yeah, I'm 4 for 4 right now. It started with 21 Jump Street, then to Lockout, then Drive, and now Argo. Drive's really good. It's Ryan Gosling. It's directed by some Danish guy, and it's got like a little synth-pop soundtrack, kind of 80s synth-pop soundtrack. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Is it like an 80s kind of action-y movie to fit the soundtrack?
It is like...
The Expendables in Cars?
It would be like The Man with No Name in a car.
So The Car with No Name?
No, The Driver with No Name.
Ah.
Yeah, but The Man with No Name, so The Driver with No Name.
Hmm. The Man with No Name in a car with no brand.
In a movie with no title.
In a joke that was funnier in my head, yet again.
Yeah, the title's Drive.
Dang it!
No, really good movie. Really enjoyed that.
So what?
I kind of went in with no preconception, so I'll leave it. I had no idea. I heard it was a good movie, so then watched it, and it's like, yeah, that's good.
The people were right.
In a Lyle with no preconceptions.
So what's going to be number 5 that potentially breaks your streak?
Oh, I don't know. I've got The Hobbit lined up. No, I've got a movie called Grabbers that I have to watch.
You haven't seen Hobbit yet?
No.
Oh, wow. You're in for a treat.
Watch that first.
DVD already.
Watch that first, and you'll be 5 for 5.
No, you gotta go where the dice go. You know, the dice say Grabbers. So,
What do you have, a magic 8 ball? That you're like, should I watch this movie?
No, it's called the Discus Order.
Huh.
Order list. So you don't always get it in the order that you request.
I see.
Well, you know, I had a magical time watching those movies. Not really. That leads into our next installment of magic.
Kind of. Oh, fantastic.
He cracks him up.
So in this episode, we're going to be looking at stage magic or magicians. So the Harry Houdinis or the David Copperfields.
Mm-hmm.
So just a reminder of what we do in Magic. What we'll do is we'll spend the first part of the episode talking about real examples of these Magic users. And then we're going to talk about how we would use them in a game. And with this challenge, I guess the big question would be, would we actually make these stage magicians actually magicians or wielders of true magic? Is there, like, true magic, what is that? I just, like, made that up.
I'm sure someone else has come up with the term true magic before you, but I don't know what you mean. Like, magic actually is real.
Yeah. As opposed to tricks on a stage, yes.
So one of the reasons why we wanted to get into the do stage magicians is just because, big fans of stage magicians.
Yeah.
Who isn't?
Yeah, it's only, just the perfect art form.
Only really sad people don't like magicians.
I can see people not liking a certain type of magician.
Or a certain magician themselves, you know?
Sure. Like a David Copperfield style is a bit too much. It's too gadgety.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I'm going to make, this jumbo jet disappear. And you're like, well, it's obviously, like, you know, mirrors or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when you have, like, a street magician like Cyril Takayama, where they're kind of, like, right there in front of you and in your face, and it's just the challenge is, like, you know, kind of catch me.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, I understand that, but I don't know. Magic, in this case, you know, the performance of magic is an art form. So while the David Copperfield, I'm going to make this jumbo jet or I'm going to make the Taj Mahal disappear, is kind of ostentatious, and I could see how that would turn some people off. For me personally, there is still the, I know it's not real. I still appreciate whatever artistry and technical design went into you pulling off that trick.
Yeah. To be honest, I've never really been that impressed with David Copperfield's ginormous tricks like that, because it's really the same. Maybe there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that I don't know about, but I see it as pretty much the same kind of thing. He's got a lot of mirrors, a lot of smoke, and he just chooses a different object to make disappear this time with the same basic technique. I've always been much more impressed with things like Penn and Teller, where it's something completely new, where they'll spray this fire hose across the stage and then walk up the line of water, that kind of thing, where it's just completely, how the heck did you do that?
I suppose. And yeah, it is a matter of taste, but isn't there a little bit of that, how did you do that, when someone makes something giant disappear?
Oh, of course there is, but once you've seen it once, then the next one, wow, you made something else giant disappear. It's, I don't know, for me, it's kind of like the difference between, you know, having a slice of cake versus gorging yourself on a whole cake. It's just too much.
I suppose.
Okay, two cakes, I can handle one cake. Same thing for Escapeology. Is Escapeology? Yeah, I'm not really that big a fan of that, but it's not that I'm not impressed by it. It's just that, okay, yeah, he's another day in the block of ice. Good job. I'll check back tomorrow. So I don't find it that exciting, but it is a good skill. So
a good skill to know.
You know, if you're bored, you might train yourself on that.
Jumping ahead to, you know, game stuff. I can see that on your sheet. You know, escapes from block of ice skill. Three ranks. There you go.
Survive in block of ice skill. Yeah. Wait, Dragon, I'm there!
Do you guys ever read that book, The Amazing Adventures of Caliper and Clay?
No, I don't think I've ever heard of it.
Yeah, I've never heard of that either.
By Michael Chabon?
No, listening to the author doesn't help.
And on the cover, it has...
Insider but, words!
Wait, how many pages?
And it's about a comics. But the character, I think he's called the Escapist.
Mm-hmm.
But he's an escapologist, and that's the superhero that they invent in the 1930s.
Oh, you know, I think you've mentioned that on the podcast before.
Yeah.
Hmm. So the story is about a comic artist who creates the character of the escapologist.
The escapist.
Oh, the escapist, sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And just like the comic book industry in general, it's two. There's an artist and a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it just, as they're writing the stories, it becomes increasingly more difficult to come up with, like, ways for him to be tied up and escape. So then he starts to get superpowers.
Hmm.
So, but yeah, I mean, the stage magician, they're a showman. And it must be difficult because they really are limited to a certain amount of tricks.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And like the Vanishing Man,
hmm.
You know, like some sort of animal appearing and disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if people are interested in just, like, looking into the stage magicians, of course, the movie The Prestige is a must-see.
Absolutely. And even if you're not into magicians, it's just a great movie to see anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And they explain, like, there's the three things. There's the pledge. Yeah, I mean, you're gonna say what you're gonna do.
Mm-hmm.
And then the turn, you do it. And then the prestige, though, is the most important thing, is because then you undo it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just kind of that idea. And I mean, they were some of the greatest showmen of their day.
Mm-hmm.
Before people invented TV and reality TV and stuff.
Oh, I think that you can still say they're greatest showmen. But I don't know, that, I guess that kind of goes back a little bit to the discussion we had at the beginning about, you know, why people like magicians. But I don't know, for me personally, I've always, yeah, okay, there's only so many tricks you can do, right? There's only so many things you can make disappear, or ways you can pull a named or marked card, you know, out of thin air. And, you know, there's a finite number of things you can do. But I almost see it as there's an infinite number of stories you can craft around that trick. You know, like, I really appreciate the misdirection and the storytelling and the setup that really good stage magicians do around the trick. And, yeah, that for me is what's interesting. And, you know, that's, for me, you know, what kid hasn't tried to do magic? You know, I had one of those giant, you know, professional magic textbooks that taught you how to do just about everything. But the crafting of the story and the engaging of the audience was the part that I could never do. And then, of course, all my magic tricks, you know, fell flat. But
well, I don't know. I mean, not to take away from your point, because I agree completely with it. I think you might be selling magicians a little bit short, and that, you know, there's, again, Penn and Teller that I mentioned before, they've been at it for, what, 30 years now? And they're still coming up with new tricks and new ways of doing it. And a lot of it, you're right, is just window dressing on the same thing. You know, a trapdoor is still a trapdoor. But, yeah, I think that there's still a lot of room for originality in coming up with new tricks.
Well, I think that's the, you know, the, what is it, limitations force creativity.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
And because they are limited to a certain amount of tricks, mm-hmm. and, I mean, hands can only do so many things, you know?
True.
That it does force them to kind of think of, like, well, how am I going to do the same old thing, but in a my way, and give it my stamp on it? So Penn and Teller do the, well, we're going to reveal it all, and we'll do the clear plastic...
props.
Props, yeah. Thank mm-hmm. you. And, you know, Cyril, he's one of the street magicians, so he'll do things. He's got his patented, like, the hamburger menu, where he makes the hamburger come out of the menu.
Mm-hmm.
Or the card that'll appear in the aquarium. So they have, like, their shtick.
Right? Yeah.
And, yeah, that's pretty amazing, because a lot of people, or a lot of professions, they don't necessarily have that, where, I mean, you give it your own signature.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yeah. Another thing is, because they are the same tricks, that there's the element of secrecy. Anybody who saw, like, Arrested Development, the TV show?
Right.
And I think Joe gets, like, blacklisted from the other stage magicians because they think he's revealing secrets.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and that's a huge part of it, because you read about some of the old magicians back in the day, and some of the rivalries were incredibly intense. The Prestige is another example of that. Because, you know, if someone has their great signature trick and they're getting famous off, you know, they're feeding their family off of it, if someone else figures it out, you know, then that could be game over. Especially if it's something like Penn and Teller, where they go on TV and reveal it to everybody. But...
Well, it's kind of like intellectual property, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's their intellectual property. That's their kind of persona, their shtick, as Lyle said. And mm-hmm. to lose that is to, you know, lose your identity, lose, you know, your persona, lose your... business in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. So
hold that thought for later on in the episode.
Holding.
Okay. Okay.
Are you gonna make it reappear later on? Can I sign my name on it?
I'm doing the pledge right now.
Exactly. He's gonna do the Prestige at the end.
Well, you bring up Arrested Development, and, you know, someone getting blacklisted for sharing secrets. Well, I don't know, I think it's really cool that a lot of magicians' guilds actually have a magician's oath. You know, kind of like the Hippocratic Oath a little bit. Or almost like, well, maybe Hippocratic Oath was a bad example. I'm thinking it more like a pledge for a fraternity, you know, or like a secret society. And they had kind of like an example of one where it's, as a magician, I promise never to reveal the secret of any illusion to a non-magician unless that one swears to uphold the magician's oath in turn. I promise never to perform any illusion for any non-magician without first practicing the effect until I can perform it well enough to maintain the illusion of magic. And I think that's really cool, because there's a lot you can do with that and the idea of professional magicians' guilds or organizations. And I'll obviously launch into an example right now.
Please do.
So, I don't know, the first thing I thought of was that...
A guild?
Whoa! Mind blown!
All it's right, funny thank, though, you, thank you for revealing all of my secrets.
No, it's just funny, because you're like, hey, a magician's guild. And everybody's probably, all the listeners are probably going, yeah, I heard of magician's guild before.
Magic I think guild? You mentioned it a minute ago.
Thieves' guilds?
All right, smart guy, can I go on?
Yeah, no, please go.
So the first thing I thought of wasn't the magician's guild.
Ooh.
But the idea of, you know, like in games, you kind of have like the Vancian magic thing, and what prevents magicians from just, you know, casting all these high-level spells or casting spells in front of people. Well, it's that clause about, I'm not going to perform magic until I can perform it well enough to maintain the illusion of magic, you know? Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be a really interesting way to explain why wizards or magical people, for lack of a better term, are now capable of casting more spells. You know, it's like, well, you knew it all the time. You had just kind of agreed not to perform it until you could do it well enough. And maybe I should have gone with guilds for my first idea.
So you mean like somebody is until they get to third level, they haven't practiced the fireball illusion well enough to let it go?
Yeah, that. Or, I don't know, I saw that as an interesting complication, you know, mm-hmm. because, as Lyle said, kind of restrictions or, not hurdles, but constraints engender creativity, you know, and also wouldn't it be, I don't know, I think an interesting part of a story to have this ability, but be unable to use it because you've sworn not to. No? Okay, it was just me.
Yeah, no, sorry. I'm having a little bit of trouble following.
I guess I get
the ideas like don't use magic until you've mastered it, kind of. I just don't see how it really relates.
Okay, I guess to put it another way, I kind of see it a little bit as like the cursed item, right? You kind of have the ability to solve problems with this thing, but you're not supposed to use it, you know. And if performing this trick, you know, that you're kind of not cleared to perform ever gets back to someone in one of those guilds, there's going to be consequences. So, but I saw that as a nice source of tension for a stage magician type character. You know, you could solve the problem, but you'll create more complications for yourself.
Hmm. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I can see that, and I can see expanding on that with talking about how you have the rival magicians and people who are out for your secrets and stuff. If you perform a new trick that no one's seen before, then there's going to be a lot of new attention on you. So that could be a constraint as well. But I think I see where you're going.
I just ruined me, Bone, but thanks, I appreciate it.
I can certainly see the idea as like, with the signature tricks, and, you know, they steal from each other, but, I mean, they try to make that fireball kind of their own. They give it, it's not a fireball, it's an ice ball or something like that.
Or it's blue instead of orange.
Mm. Yeah, something like that, and you put your own flavor on it.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is, you know, because to make it your own, but the other is to kind of hide that you stole it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So,
or to improve on it, make it one up it so that people come and see you instead of that other hocus guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the business end of a fireball.
I'm sorry, Wayne. Fireball was a terrible example for me to use.
No, but, you know, I almost see this as then you could play a Shadowrun type game, because in Shadowrun, you're often trying to steal tech or software or some other kind of intellectual property. And why not have a game where you are magicians or magician, you know, assistants or have been hired by magicians to steal other people's tricks so that, you know, they can put their own fingerprint on it.
Oh, how fun of a game would that be? You play a bunch of thieves who are hired by a magician to go steal a trick from another magician only to find out that magic is real. Whoa. Yeah, sorry for the Keanu Reeves impression of that. Whoa.
Nah, I can see it now. I know magic.
Show me.
Fireball.
So another thing that stage magician has is they have a supporting cast. Of course, there's the assistant, the lovely assistant or assistants who provide a distraction.
That's how you know magicians really made it. Assistants, plural.
And then there's the sometimes the shill,
right,
in the audience. And then there's I guess the engineer, the prop master in the back, who makes the thing. So that's pretty interesting, you know.
Mm-hmm. So what you seem to be saying is like you could almost form a party around a magician, kind of like we did for the pulp game. You know, you'd have the magician and then assistant, you know, kind of the attention drawer and the prop guy. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at a game like Leverage or you look at a game like Spycraft,
right?
They really built it around, like, here's your A team, your spy team. Mm-hmm. And yeah, or even like a rogue trader, where it's always like, it's all built around the rogue trader. And then right. Here it's like, yeah, it's all built around the stage magician, but each person brings something to the table. Sure, the stage magician is the showman, but he or she is not as charismatic as the assistant.
Right.
And the shill maybe is like a master of disguise. Mm-hmm. And then the engineer, of course, as an engineer, yeah. It's kind of the gadgeteer.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a really good way to balance it. You know, as you mentioned, kind of, you know, leverage. Everybody works together as a team, and everybody kind of is working to back up this one guy. But everybody also has skills that the other team members can't duplicate. So everybody is pretty much just as important as everybody else. So I think that's important in a group. Or I could even see a game where the magician is an NPC, you know, and the adventure or the storyline wouldn't really be about the performance so much, but stuff leading up to it and, you know, what has to happen before the performance.
Well, it could be the stage magician could be a cover.
Right.
And he's the NPC, but then they, you know, they're not just a performance group. They are like crack spies or whatever,
right,
using the
right.
skills that they have. Hey, you know, this is kind of a little off topic, but you ever watch 28 Days Later?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right? And it's got that really cool line at the beginning, and it was like, what were you guys researching or something? Mm-hmm. And he's like, rage.
Yeah.
You know, just like a really cool line. And just like, you could have the apprentice, and it's like, what do you bring to the table? And he's like, hunger. So he's a, I don't know, does that make sense?
And then eats everybody and they turn into...
Sorry, I'm not seeing this. And then magical hunger zombies?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. I was like, they've infected those chimpanzees with magical hunger. Watch out.
Sorry, no, I'm not catching what you're throwing.
So it's like you have the stage magician, but then you also have the apprentice. And what does the apprentice have that the stage magician doesn't have? And that's hunger. So they'll try the risky things. You see that in The Prestige. You know, they'll try riskier tricks.
Right.
They're not as good, they're not as famous, but they'll take the risks because they're hungry. They need to advance. Hmm.
Motivation, drive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I went with hunger, but yeah, you could have.
But the hilarity ensued over the chimp references.
And well, the lovely assistant. what does a lovely assistant bring to the table? Legs.
What was with that laugh?
All right, moving on.
Yeah.
So, like, you guys bringing up stealing other magicians' secrets and, you know, Penn and Teller especially kind of revealing how magic is done, it makes me think of, like, secrecy. And secrecy is a big part of magic, as we've said. And there's kind of two schools of thought on the topic of secrecy. One is which, you know, if the general population kind of knows how tricks are done, then it kind of kills magic as an art form. You know, you kind of take the artistry out of it, and once the audience knows how something is done, people have argued that they can never really fully enjoy that trick again. Kind of like you said at the beginning, Chris, you know, oh, I've seen, you know, that jumbo jet disappear. He made something else big disappear, an elephant. Well, it's the same thing. I kind of know how it's done. So that's kind of one reason to keep tricks a secret. The other school of thought is that kind of what Penn and Teller do, that revealing the trick is just another form of misdirection, you know? And I'm pretty sure I've seen Penn and Teller, you know, do their clear prop tricks. But then at the end of their performance, they always, or almost always, do something that's not explained or seems even more supernatural or impossible because they have been using clear props for the entire previous part of the performance, you know? So, I don't know, I think that's kind of interesting. How you almost kind of have these two rival schools of thought about whether magic tricks should remain secret or not.
Well, I've heard Penn and Teller rationalize it with saying that they want to force other magicians to innovate. They don't want them to be able to just play on one trick over and over again for ad nauseum. But, you know, I'm just as impressed when they've used the clear props at the amount of the skill and artistry that they have with it. So that doesn't bother me at all for it.
None.
But
Sorry, you actually brought up that third point, you know, that third, you know, school of thought where, yeah, it'll force people to innovate. So, anyway, again, using that in a game, I see that as a great opportunity for rivalry and, you know, kind of conflict within a game. You know, like, if you do take the idea of magicians' guilds or professional organizations, for lack of a better term, I almost kind of saw it like the Inquisition from Warhammer 40,000, you know? They're all kind of going towards the same goal, but all of them are going at it from different angles.
I think, like, it's not so much about games, but I think somebody like Penn and Teller works because they're the only ones doing it, but who would really want to go to a magic show and watch, like, clear props every time?
Yeah, you're right. It spoils the mystique, spoils the magic of it.
Yeah, so I think a lot of times it's like, I mean, magic is the only profession where people want to be lied to. They know they're being lied to when they go in, and they love it, you know? And the better liar you are, the more they like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I was reading that Houdini was kind of the guy who really got that popularized to where he stopped pretending that it was magic and just went out saying, yeah, this is an illusion. I'm just really good at doing this, so I'm lying to you now. But I read something from a psychologist, and I'm not sure if I actually buy it, but they're saying that they doubted if magic would still be a popular performance art nowadays if it hadn't had kind of that open dishonesty about it. Because when the Industrial Revolution came around, a lot of the hocus-pocus entertainment acts went away. And those things like, they had a lot of psychics and like Ouija board kind of reading things, and those all died out, but magic stayed alive as an entertainment form.
I don't know if that's true or not, but I mean, I kind of agree with it because, as Lyle said, magic is kind of, you know, one of the only art forms where the audience expects and wants to be lied to. So, like, I while doing research for this episode, I read that, you know, some modern illusionists, they think it's kind of wrong or unethical to claim their performance is anything other than a skillful deception. You know, they don't go into it intentionally trying to make the audience think it's something other than a magic trick, where the things you described, you know, Chris, I think that may have been their intention, you know, try to fool people into believing that this thing is real, where magic said, no, it's, or magician said, no, it's not real. You know it's not real, but you're still going to enjoy trying to figure out how we did this or doing that, which I think is probably why magic stayed around. You know?
Yeah, it's the difference between David Copperfield and Madame Cleo.
Yeah, I
sorry,
guess.
What?
the difference between David Copperfield and Madame Cleo, you know?
Oh, I see, yeah.
Couldn't get through Chris's thick Jamaican accent.
Yeah. But, you know, and there's also a lot of magicians who, or I suppose illusionists is probably a better word, that's one they would take, that go around and they try to bust fake psychics and charlatans and things like that. James Randi is a great one to watch for that.
Yeah, Houdini did that.
Yeah, absolutely.
His wife was going to give him, like, a code word during, to do those, like, seances. And if it was actually true, she was going to give a code word. And he never found one.
What a surprise.
So I think, the big... So now, I mean, we move into the part of the episode where we suppose, what if it were real? So, I think, Chris, you were talking about how something about, like, high magic or something like that with stage magicians?
Urban fantasy.
Urban fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it a dozen times on the show before. I really, really love that genre. So that's kind of what I jump for right away. But I mean, I figure the idea of if you're in this urban fantasy where there's kind of the secret layer of magic underneath the real world, like the masquerade kind of thing, what better way to hide the fact that you're actually a magician than to be a magician, you know, kind of the hiding in plain sight kind of thing. And yeah, I just think that that's would be so much fun, that magic actually is real, but you have to take pains to make sure that no one discovers that it is real, even when you're performing it right in front of them. And you could have a lot of fun with, like you were mentioning before, Wayne, with magical guilds and secret societies of the sort. For example, the Golden Dawn, which we talked about in a previous magic episode. I figured make the spells, the actual like spells written down, incantations, that way, again, the secrecy is really important, and there'd be a lot of drama and maybe trying to go around and steal magic spells from other magicians and such instead of their tricks, quote unquote. Fun.
Yeah, I think that could be, because I like urban fantasy too, but a lot of times you run up against the problem of why don't people know this is real? You know, you're not doing a very good job of hiding it. And I don't know, a lot of those stories kind of center around, you know, this person the main character finding out, oh, there's this secret world, and it's like, well, if you, kind of this ordinary schlub, found out about that, how come the doors haven't been blown wide open on whatever secrets are being hidden? But
because if you say something, they will turn you into a frog.
I guess so. But you know,
well, I suppose there is a point of suspension of disbelief, just like any of the World of Darkness games. You know, how is it that no one has discovered the vampires yet?
No, that's true. Even though I think they did that pretty good. But anyway, the point was that you know,
maybe just my idea sucks.
No. I think the point you brought up about you know everybody, at least in the real world, assumes magic doesn't work. You know, they want to be lied to, as we've said. So, yeah, it would be cool to hide magic right out in the open behind stage magic.
Mm-hmm.
So I like your idea, and I think it's one of the ones that probably could work. Or you would not have to suspend your disbelief as much as in other, you know, kind of settings I've seen.
Yeah, like I said, I think it'd be really fun. I figured you could probably take like the stages, the actual theaters where they perform, and have them as like I don't know, like places of power, like ley line focuses or something. So that's why they're there. They get extra power, and that's where monsters are more likely to pop out of rifts or something, stealing a page from rifts.
Well, that does kind of add the added wrinkle of hey, well, that's the third audience I've had devoured by that interspatial monster. Maybe he's not in the theater.
No, he fights, and it's like it's all part of the show, folks.
Yeah, exactly. There was this old anime that I saw ages ago that I've always wanted to replicate in a game. It's kind of where when these two rival factions would face off, they'd kind of create this alternate bubble of reality that was the same place around, but even though they would destroy buildings and streets and stuff, when the alternate reality was closed, everything would be returned to normal like that. I've always wanted to kind of incorporate that into a game, but it never really worked because if you can just destroy anything and there's no consequences, so.
Right.
Meh. But anyway, yeah.
Hmm. You know, I actually would be reluctant to make a stage magician, you know, make the magic real, even if it was like a low form of magic.
You're trying to say that it's exactly like the real world, right?
Yeah, they're real tricks in that they are real tricks.
Okay.
They are tricking people into kind of like suspending their disbelief. But it's not actually real magic in the sense that it's out of Tolkien or Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
But the things that you would do with that, I mean, you kind of have like a part gadgeteer, as we mentioned earlier. What they do with the gadgets, and you could kind of play with that a little bit, and maybe the gadgets are a little bit more spectacular than, and maybe a little bit more portable than, you know, in real life.
Mm-hmm.
The sleight of hand is just a little bit better than it is in real life, but still, it's okay. Still kind of within the kind of the confines of reality.
Right.
Huh. Well, you know, that idea that you brought up earlier with the team, you know, your assistant, your gadgeteer, and then the guy on stage, I mean, I think that's a fantastic idea. I hadn't thought of it myself, so, I mean, it sounds like it'd be a lot of fun to play. And I suppose you could bring it to make something even larger than life, you know, maybe have some kind of weird science that enables some of these tricks. Some of the gadgets are, well, like you said, it's a little bit out of the bounds of what's actually possible, but still, I don't know, somewhat believable.
Yeah.
That sounds like it'd be a lot of fun.
Like a mystery man, you know, like where they go and they learn at the hands of some like yogi and the on top of or in Shangri-La or whatever.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And they learn. That's where they learn to escape or to stop their breath or stop their heart. I was when I was a kid, we would go on Saturday afternoons, maybe Sunday afternoons, can't remember, to the theater, and we would watch like old time serials. They were color, so they weren't quite from the 30s, but you would go one week and, you know, it would end on a cliffhanger, and then you would have to come back the next week to watch these, like, serials. And they would be before, like, the main movie again, which would be kind of old.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just great matinees. And I remember one. I can't remember the name of this guy. He's something like a Doc Savage or like a Phantom. But he had a red costume. And the car literally goes over a cliff, crashes. Then a doctor takes his pulse and goes, checks his pulse. And he's like, he's dead, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then you're like walking out of the theater. And it's like, how is he going to come back alive? I mean, they just said he was dead. So, of course, next week it was like, well, I just slowed down my heart rate. And you're like, BS.
Sorry.
Lyle's like 6-year-old, but he's still like, that's crap.
Yeah, sorry. This was to sell the idea of magicians. I mean, like, you seem to be advocating, like, people walking around going, oh, yeah, how do you do that? Yeah, well, obviously a trick. BS.
It's like last week's episode, Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
No, but I think, like, you know, that could be a lot of fun instead of just having like the World of Darkness where, hey, we're actually pretending to be stage magicians, but we're really magicians. And this is like, no, you know, we know some tricks, and maybe we know slightly more tricks than the average magician, but it's still all gadget and sleight of hand.
No, I could see, I don't know, this might be, you know, too much of a twist, but I could see a setting where it's kind of the Magician's Guild's job to make people believe magic is real.
Yeah, I was thinking that same thing.
You know?
I'd like to do that kind of in a, almost in a fantasy setting. You know, you take some of the modern ideas of tricks that are about there, you know, watch some Penn and Teller so that you have some ideas about how to do things, and then put it in like a medieval, not a fantasy really, but a medieval setting, you know, where you are playing a quote-unquote wizard and you're doing these magic tricks to convince everyone that magic is real. That could be a lot of fun.
I could see that, and I just thought of this now, because for some reason I was thinking medieval setting as well too, Chris, maybe because people back then were a bit more gullible, or maybe not, maybe they're just as gullible as they are now, I don't know. But I just kind of thought that could be kind of dark. Because in that case, you are intentionally lying to people, you know?
Yes.
So I guess it would kind of be a slightly evil game, you know? Because what would you do with that other than lie to and misdirect people and convince them magic is real? Probably for personal gains. So
I know you could do a kind of a leveraged thing, you know, where you're helping people out and solving problems and such, even though you're not using the legitimate ways of doing so.
Yeah, thank you for stealing my point. That's exactly what I was going to say. All right.
Booyah!
I'll be quiet now.
Some sleight of hand right there.
I know. Pulled that thought right out of my ear.
So yeah, I can see that being fun. It sounds really hokey, but yeah, I can see that even today, with professional magicians who are using their skills with magic to go out and solve crimes. Sounds like a Scooby-Doo plot.
Yeah, no, that'd be a lot of fun. Like, yeah, I don't know. It's like, I think with a stage magician, once you start to say, what if it is real, then it is like real magic, then, I mean, what is he now? He's a
wizard.
He's a wizard that wants to, you know, perform in Vegas? I don't know. Like,
it pays well.
No, I suppose it pays well. I mean, it could be, I mean, we've talked about it in a couple episodes. It's like, what if magic were real? And, you know, how would that really shape society? Mm-hmm. We've talked about, you know, like, you know, sickness, you know, why would you have apothecaries if the guys can just lay hands and things like that?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And ways around that. But, I mean, if you have magic, yeah, I suppose. I mean, magic's pretty cool, and it is the big draw, the entertainment draw.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, it's the kind of thing, it is a perfect cover, you know. If you're what's the name of a good street magician? David Blaine, is he one?
Yep. No. He is a street magician.
Okay.
Oh, burn!
Cyril.
All right, then.
Cyril.
Yeah, but nobody in the U.S. knows him.
Chris Angel?
Chris Angel. I don't like him either. Oh, okay, anyway. Sorry. I'll dash these split hairs off the side. But, you know, it makes the perfect cover. If you were somebody like Chris Angel or David Blaine or Ciro Takayama or whatever his name is, you could, if you're out, you know, doing some magic for some reason, investigating a crime or hunting a monster or whatever, and somebody sees you and walks up to you and says, holy cow, what are you doing? He's like, oh, it's a trick. Here, there's a quarter in your ear, that kind of thing. It just makes a good cover if you're trying to maintain some kind of masquerade, as is often the case in urban fantasy.
I guess so. I'm wondering, like, what would it be like if magic was real, but instead of being very, like, high-powered magic, you know, epic magic, what if it was just very minor?
Yeah, there you go. Street magic, literally. Street-level magic.
Yeah, you know. Like, if all the magic can really do is make, you know, a quarter disappear, or, you know, make a name pop up on a card.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it kind of combines the two ideas, because, as Lyle said, like, if you do have all that D&D, you know, kind of, or typical D&D magic, then why do you have to keep it hidden? You need like to come up with like a really, really good reason about why you don't just like come out and use it, you know. But if it's kind of small magic that doesn't really do all that much, well, then it doesn't really do anything, and there's less of a reason to hide it, you know.
That's really, really good, Wayne. I think if I were to do this kind of a urban fantasy game, I would really like to keep it at that kind of level where you're limited to do the kind of things that stage magicians can do. Levitate someone a few feet off of the ground or something, or teleport across the room instead of across the world. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think you have a lot of fun with that, those kind of limitations. As you said before, Lyle, you know, the limitations are what breeds creativity. Or did you say that, Wayne?
No, that was Lyle.
Okay. And you're a genius.
Not an original one. I was thinking when you're talking about like just the like regular magicians like or wizards, you could actually have the researcher wizard, the battle wizard, but then the entertainer, and that's what it is, and it's like in the society there are wizards that's all they do is they entertain, and it could be an interesting. I mean, you could take like just a regular fantasy game, and somebody's going to play the wizard, and instead of like, oh, I'm going to be the battle mage or kind of the traditional mage, I'm going to be like the entertainment mage, and not like a bard, but like this guy or this girl specialize in entertainment magic. And when you're looking at your spell list, it's kind of gets into what Wayne's talked about with limiting the power of the spells, but you can also limit the type of spells. So if you're looking at a typical fantasy game where you have what hundreds and hundreds of spells, and people default to the same one, magic missile, fireball, or the same ones. No, you have to get things that are flashy, that have some entertainment value.
Like fireball and magic missile.
Right.
No,
but I hear you saying something.
Sleep.
No, you'd have sleep, just the reverse. Awake, like, I'm not done my trick yet. Wake up.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know, if you're a stage magician and it's about getting money on there, sleep might be pretty useful for that.
Well, then you should become a thief.
But, exactly.
No, you were talking about like entertainment magic, and I kept thinking about like a previous episode where we said, why doesn't anyone just use illusion as you really would use the illusion spell, you know?
That's right, the porn illusions.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, I'm an entertainer wizard. All I have is illusion, phantom sound, and... a spell to do tactile stuff. There you go.
Hey, how about the, it's like, hey, can't you like make an illusion of a monster? And he's like, no, but I can make an illusion of a beautiful woman. Yeah, so it's not going to come in handy. Well, let's try it.
Yeah.
That happens. They do take the typical spells, but they refine it where, the fireball actually does not do anything, but it's extra bright. And it follows people around, and it's like firework.
Yeah, it changes shape or something like that.
Yeah.
That kind of leads into what we were saying before. Once you take the spell, like fireball, but you have to make it your own. Like we said before, it was turn it blue or make it an ice ball or something. But yeah, absolutely. It's like give it some kind of signature twist. Make all of your spells come out blue or something like that.
That would be pretty cool. I'm just thinking because like it would have consequence, or... like spells, or most, again, I'm thinking D&D, you always have that, like, detect magic spell, where maybe you pick up that little aura, like, oh, yep, magic was used here, and kind of, wouldn't it be cool to, detect, like, blue dust on the floor and be like, oh, okay.
This was Penn and Teller.
Exactly, we know who was here, and that's just kind of, like, another clue you can drop, to keep things interesting.
Or some NPC frames you by doing the same effect.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, that would be good, yeah.
You kind of get into, using magic as technology a little bit. And, what can we do with technology now? Great, okay, now port that over to magic,
No, but it's also like a fingerprint.
Yeah.
So you're like, I'm innocent, this guy dies. And you're like, I'm innocent, No, but it was a blue fireball that killed him, everybody said.
Yep.
You were the only one that does blue fireball.
Yep. And then you have to figure out who stole your intellectual property.
It wasn't me. It was a one-armed magician.
Maybe there isn't enough like courtroom dramas
about magicians.
About in fantasy, like not necessarily courtroom drama, but kind of like like an investigation or somebody being framed in a setup.
Right.
You kind of take like a double indemnity, but in a fantasy setting.
I agree 100%. I've had that once before in a game where there was an actual proper court in the game. It was it was in D&D as well, where everybody prepared a defense and offense, and it was fantastic, a lot of fun. We should do an episode on that.
Well, it probably doesn't even have to be like an actual court, So it could just be, somebody accuses you personally, and then okay, so now you have to go bring evidence in front of the magistrate or whatever. So.
Yeah, it could be the start of the adventure. It's like, we would think to do that in a modern setting, but not so much in a science fiction or a fantasy setting. The kind of like you just start with like you've been wrongly accused, like The Fugitive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a bit of a tangent here? But do you think that's possibly because we have due process now, whereas in like if you're modeling it on the Middle Ages, it'd be like that person accused you, they're a higher rank. Off you go to the headsman. There you go.
Well, I mean, that wasn't all societies all towns, you know.
I realize
people often had a chance to prove themselves innocent.
Yeah, but by torture. Okay, if you can withstand, you can withstand these hot irons, yeah, you're innocent. Oh, you died in the process. So sorry. But at least you're in heaven now.
Sure, if you want to play in the time of the Spanish Inquisition, yes.
I mean, you could just play with it. I mean, you create your own legal system. Mm-hmm. You know, base it off, you know, something from history or what we have now and, you know, magic it up. Well, think about
it. Would have to be... Go on.
Well, if you had mages, I mean, we're kind of getting away from stage magicians, but, I mean, if you had mages that were or around and priests, I mean, with detect lies and things like that.
Yeah, the same point I was going to bring up, yeah.
Do you have a, you know, defense? I do. Merlin the Magnificent! This wizard walks into the courtroom. No?
Oh, is he the defense attorney?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Not that. No, I was like, you have a defense, and he's like, I thought he said his name.
No.
Merlin the Magnificent.
You're like, I meant like,
okay, that's your name, sir. Are you entering a plea of not guilty?
Place your wand on the Bible.
I'm entering a plea of insanity!
Good place to leave it there.
No, we'll have to come back to that and devote, yeah, like you said, Chris, an episode on the legal systems in game.
Okay, good. I thought the insanity of Merlin the Magician. Cool.
Or you could do it where it's, I don't know, it's like sometimes it's real and sometimes it's not. And it's really inconsistent, so they actually have to learn the trick so they have some sort of consistency.
Ooh, that's really cool, where the tricks actually are the thing that brings out the real magic.
It could be. Well, no, that's a little bit different than I was thinking. So you're thinking it's the ritual, right?
Mm-hmm.
And triggers like a real magic. And I'm thinking it's like, okay, you've got to do a Vanishing Man act, but you're not always able to do the Vanishing Man act or spell. Have to have again, you're an entertainer, so you have that, I mean, those nightly shows. So you have to have the tricks ready in case it doesn't work. And then sometimes it's so unpredictable, then it's like wild magic. I mean, you disappear for like a week kind of thing.
That's got to suck for ticket sales.
Or would be awesome for ticket sales, you know?
That's kind of, if magic is that unpredictable, maybe if I was a professional magician, I'd just rely on the tricks because, you know, they work.
Well, that's when you combine your two ideas and you're like, okay, you know, doing the trick is the ritual, but you never know what the result is going to be. So maybe this time the guy actually is going to disappear.
I pull a lion out of my hat.
Yeah. I didn't mean that. But imagine what their ticket sales would be after that. I'm going to pull a rabbit out of my hat, and oh my god, it's a tiger! Then hopefully the magic isn't as unpredictable, and you can make it disappear again.
Hopefully. Still giggling over that plea of insanity!
All right.
Sorry.
Made perfect sense in my head.
That was great.
Well, in my head, I said defense attorney.
Well, you could do it to where the... I don't know, it could be really complicated, but something where the effect of the spell is dependent on how much the target buys into it. So if your prestige is really good, where they're convinced that this is something extremely powerful and dangerous, then it actually does have that large of an effect on them. Whereas if they're really skeptical of it, like, whatever, then maybe it's much lessened. So you really have to sell it when you do it.
You're kind of using belief as a fuel for your spells.
Yeah, but man, that would be hard to run in a game, I reckon, because the DM would have to kind of gauge the belief of the NPC when you're doing it and how well you're doing it. I suppose that could be on a dice roll.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, yeah, doesn't that play into, like, you know, skills? And it encourages people to have, you know, the sleight of hand skill or, you know, bluff, diplomacy, fast talk, stuff like that to actually convince the target that, you know, what they're doing is spectacular. And then on top of that, you'd also need, like, a little bit of a magic skill to actually do the thing. And,
yeah, you could kind of tie that into what Lyle was saying before, to where the trick is unpredictable. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. If you're able to generate enough, for lack of a better word, belief in the target that you actually are doing magic, then that's when the magic actually happens. I don't, maybe if you're doing it with some kind of dice mechanic with a skill, you have to pass a certain threshold, at which point you can add magical bonuses.
Yeah, or if you're using World of Darkness, it's just, okay, how many successes did you get on that roll to convince them? And that's how many you get on your roll to actually do it.
Yeah, there you go. And then you can spend those successes on actual real magical effects rather than just the trick.
Right.
All right, George, I think we're onto something.
Pulled that out of a hat.
You could do something maybe similar to Changeling, where they they require kind of the emotion of the crowds, like they're emotional vampires or something. And that could be an explanation as to why they perform in front of crowds, do something amazing with their powers, and then kind of just soak in the reaction.
Yeah, you could definitely do something with that.
Or vice versa, evil magicians use fear, or something like that.
Evil magicians use fear. Nice. Yes. Magicians use happiness.
Yes, exactly.
Are we talking about using the crowd?
Yeah.
And then that means all your combats have to take place in front of a crowd?
Not necessarily, but maybe that's where you get, again, for lack of a better term, maybe your magic points is you pull in the emotions of people. And of course you can store them. So if you do a really big show, you get a really big reaction, then you kind of get flooded with all these magical points, which you can use for a while, but then eventually it starts to run down. So you can do, you know, simple tricks in front of a few people to get a little trickle of magical energy, or you could do it in a big theater and kind of it all just pours in. So people like Houdini, you know, really famous magicians, they can attract crowds of thousands, you know, they're extremely powerful for all this, but maybe kind of street performers wouldn't be as powerful because they can only get a little bit at a time.
I don't know. I kind of like the idea of having to, you know, do it in front of a crowd, because then, you know, that's another... I mean, too many constraints just break the game, you know? You mm-hmm. can't do anything. But a few constraints make things interesting, because the players mm-hmm. have to be creative. So it's almost like the opposite of old mage, you know, where mm-hmm. you have to kind of do magic in such a way where no one believes it was magic. Whereas mm-hmm. here, it's like, no, the larger the crowd that's watching you, the better you're going to perform, if yeah. you can convince them. So yeah, all your kind of big fights would have to take place with crowds watching. So
Okay, sure. I'm not 100% sold on that, but I know what you guys are doing. It's like, yeah, feeding off of the group. But I was thinking about the reverse mage there, or like a mage, just for people who didn't play it, is like you have to kind of make your spells like plausible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, the classic example is you cast like lightning, but it's really just, you know, a power line fell down and electrocuted the guy.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Cast fireball, and it was just a gas man explosion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, with the, if we go back to the, you know, stage magicians are really just stage magicians, you know, the tricks, then it's almost like a leverage or a mage kind of mechanic where they can do some really, really amazing things, but they have to explain it away in a mundane way. Mm-hmm. Unlike mage, they're not actually casting spells and explaining it away so that the paradox spirits don't come after them.
Right.
Yeah.
Here that you're just explaining it, how you were able to do that, how you're able to, like, you know, teleport, you know, 10 meters.
Yeah, I thought of that earlier on as we were discussing the episode, but I kind of stopped myself because I was thinking, you know, maybe it sounds like it could be a lot of fun with the right group of players, but to demand on someone that they have to be able to come up with a good mundane explanation of how they got that trick to work, it could be pretty tough to come up with that. But I mean, I suppose, you know, the point of role-playing games is to get in there and tell a story and exercise your imagination, so I don't want to say no, but it could be tough.
Yeah, it could be, but I mean, like, kind of like anything, if it's set up properly, you know, the players know they're going to have to do this, so mm-hmm. again, if they have, like, their standby magic tricks, which are easy to explain away, you know, those are mm-hmm. kind of like, for lack of a better term, like at-will spells, and well, they won't be maybe that powerful or... You know, people kind of get wise to them. But then, no, you want to do something spectacular? Well, then come up with something spectacular. You know, mm-hmm. explain away why you were able to do that. So,
yeah. And there's some players who would just, there's some players who would just eat that up too. So,
some players would be just like, can't I just roll my dice?
Exactly. I swing my sword or my wand.
Oh, it was, how do I explain it away? It was magic. You're like, get out of my table. Get out of my table.
Magic. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, well, that ends our episode on stage magicians, and it sounds like we're going to be having an episode on the legal system pretty soon.
Without magicians.
Riveting.
Dun, gong, gong. These are their stories.
Law and Order the episode, I'm still there.
Yeah, that'll be pretty good. We'll have to do that. All right. I think that was it.
Yep. Okay, cool. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Over to Hands. Check us out online at www.idleredhands.com, at overtohands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through Stitcher or iTunes, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can contact us through comments on the webpage, or through Facebook, or just send us an email at info@idleredhands.com, because we always love hearing from all of you. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
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 DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.